Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. The author of a highly fascinating book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now, is with us, Douglas Rushkoff. He's a media theorist, author of 12 books, including Life Incorporated and Program or Be Programmed. He's a commentator on CNN, a contributor to The Guardian, Discover, and NPR. He wrote and hosted three PBS documentaries, The Merchants of Cool, looking at the influence of corporations on youth culture, The Persuaders, about the landscape of marketing and digital nation, which is about life on the virtual frontier, The Persuaders and Digital Nation. He teaches at NYU, and the New School focuses on the ways people, cultures, and institutions create, share, and influence each other's values. Some of you may remember the culture analysis Future Shock by Alvin Toffler. It was a book that was widely read and discussed. It proposed too much change in too short a period of time would be the norm of the future, and our guest this hour is saying, well, we're there now, and that we're less interested in building a better future than in constructing a meaningful present. And my goodness, do we have a lot of ways to construct that meaningful present with Twitter and with emails and with constant news information and our devices to tell us as soon as something happens, and it's quite a pace, isn't it? So Douglas is our guest this hour, and I think we're going to get a lot of phone calls on this. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and because we haven't entirely embraced the world of now, I won't give you our Twitter account, but we do have one, and we need to do more of that because it is what people are doing, but we do have one. So join us for this interesting conversation. Douglas, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What a fascinating book this is. I mean, it just is so interesting because you've thought very deeply about the very thing that's keeping us from thinking very deeply.
Yeah, it's funny. When you were describing the now, you know, I don't know that I would count Twitter feeds and updates and SMSs as part of the real now as much as the kind of false now that we're being distracted to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. You know, the real now that I'm, you know, personally more interested in is the real now of living socially with other human beings and, you know, looking into people's eyes and experiencing a social reality, you know, which seems in some ways to be the now that is getting less and less accessible to us, you know, as we get further entrained and entranced by our digital devices.
Mm-hmm. One of the early stories you tell, I thought it's funny, but it's so sad, of this young woman who's at a party and she's trying to find out if she's at the best party. So she's at her device finding out what other parties are going on. Tell us that story. It's such an indication of where we are right now.
I know. It's a little sad.
I know.
You know, I was, doing a lot of research into the way, you know, the way different generations of people use devices, and young people in particular. And I went to this, following this girl around to see how she used her stuff. And, she was at one party, and she wasn't really looking around at the people or engaging with anybody. She was just in her device texting people from other parties to see, you know, who's at the best party, you know, just to get news from the various parts around town to see. And she goes from party to party texting, you know, various things until she finally gets to the party that in theory is the party she wants to be at. You know, this is the one that she's decided is right. And all she does is she turns around her smartphone and starts taking pictures at that party and uploading them to Twitter or Pinterest or, you know, whichever Facebook program she's using. And she was never really there in some sense. You know, she was never actually at any of these parties. She was either at a party trying to find out about the other ones or broadcasting her experience rather than even having it.
Oh, my goodness. The only time I really felt I was thinking about this as I was reading your book that and I've been in broadcasting for a long, long time, so I'm of another generation. But the only time I really felt like I had to ask myself, what in the world are you doing, was the night of they were trying to find the suspects in the Boston bombing, and it was fairly late at night. So I get kind of wrapped up sometimes in these TV things that are going on that are analyzing these big things, and they go on and on forever. So I'm watching that, and then I decided, oh, I can follow this on Twitter. So for hours, I am so involved in the now, and I don't know if it's good information or bad, but there was something about the process of just reading all the feeds that were coming in, and my family was there, and I felt so proud of myself because I was giving them information that was before what the television was saying. And at the end, I thought, what the heck is this all about? What am I doing? I was caught up in the now, very much caught up in the now, huh? Douglas? Well, Douglas is gone. Hello? I don't know. Well, at any rate, I don't know if he ever even heard that story. We're going to have to try to reconnect with him. Let's try again. Douglas? Now we've lost our feed here somehow. At any rate, we'll talk more about these kinds of being in the now. The book has a lot of substance to it, too, because he looks at how we've really needed a narrative for years and years, and we have lost that as well.
Oh, my gosh.
There we go.
You're back with me? All right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Something happened there. At any rate, I just told a story, but we can move on. The audience heard it.
No, I heard it. I mean,
oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just for some reason you couldn't hear me when I was trying to respond.
Right.
Yeah, the Boston story in some ways is a great example of present shock in the fact that so many of us were willing to really throw ourselves into the state of the newsroom person. You know,
yes.
When I was in college, we used to get the AP feed would come in, remember, and it would ding how many times, you know, twice if it's kind of important, three times if it's really important. You know, you live in that kind of emergency room-like state where you're, you know, ready to see what's happening now. And I feel like part of that is because the news cycle really isn't there anymore. We don't have Walter Cronkite to turn to at the end of the day to find out what happened. We've got 24/7 news, whether it's on CNN or on our Twitter feed or on the net somewhere, that there isn't this sense of getting the story after we know the story. There's a sense of getting the information before we even have any context for it.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, we're living in news stories that don't really have that same story structure to them anymore. It's not, oh, the Russians did this thing and now we're going to go get them back. It's more a random horrible thing has happened somewhere that no one understands, and no one really understands what the motivation is or if it's going to happen again. And if it does, when it's going to, it's this weird steady state sense of crisis and emergency, which is very different from the good old fashioned 20th century, you know, wars that we got to report on.
And that's what we're being fed. And when I read what you said about that, that's really true, isn't it? That we're living in this state of trauma because that is what the now is. It's you got to be on the lookout. You got to be careful if there's danger ahead.
Right. Well, it's certainly the now as it's filtered to us through digital devices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, digital technology is truly different from analog technology. In some ways, it's better because we're released from the captive spell of our broadcast programmers. Not everything has to come through the filters of News Corp or William Randolph Hearst to get to us. We're in a peer-to-peer media space. But it's also pinging us incessantly and constantly and in these short, interrupted bursts. So it's a very different kind of assault on the nervous system. Better in some ways because it's unfiltered and uncensored, but very difficult in other ways because we feel compelled to pay attention to it,
yes.
To pay attention to the whatever story, you know, Casey Anthony or these, you know, how do we even pick which of the, you know, which murder story we're going to all watch as a nation and which, you know, are going on every day that we pay absolutely no attention to? It's, you know, what gets picked up, but it keeps us really striving to stay connected to this, unfolding, seeming narrative of tweets and bursts. And it makes real life, and this is what I get concerned about, it makes real life, the life of our spouses and children and people who work with us in our classes, in our communities, it makes that in many ways less accessible to us.
Yeah. You talk a lot in the book about our needing a narrative, about stories being so important to us historically that we need it for gaining understanding. There have been no societies that were able to last that did not tell stories. Can you talk more about that?
Well, you know, stories are great containers for values. You know, I sometimes think when, you know, how you have to tell your kid a story for them to go to sleep at night.
Right.
I started to think, well, you know, it's interesting. All right, I'll tell you a story, but, you know, I'm actually going to slip into this story that, you know, I'm going to get my something out of it too. And I'm going to be putting into this story, you know, the values I want you to take
yes.
with you along the way. It's interesting. And I think all stories really have that. You know, there's there's a beginning, middle, and then a crisis and climax. The main character has this recognition and that shape that we really, you know, Aristotle first recognized really of crisis, climax, recognition, and sleep, you know, has dominated the way we transmit values, you know, whether it's Christianity or capitalism or communism or messianism, it's always you strive towards some goal. So our political and social movements have always been these eyes on the prize journeys to completion. We're going to have an ends justifies the means campaign to victory. And then at least when it's over, the winners will win, the losers will be vanquished and damned, and we can move on. And that kind of story structure is much less consonant with a digital age, with digital technology, whether it's remote controls and DVRs that let us escape the captive spell of narration, or move back and forth through it, or switch channels between different stories at once, or whether it's the sort of Generation X style television programming of Beavis and Butthead or The Simpsons or South Park, which alienates us from that kind of a story,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's digital technology, which is just so interruptive that you don't really do things in terms of stories. You tend to move through entertainment much more like a video game now, where you are the character rather than watching some other character, and you are making the choices as that move you through the story. It's a very different sensibility. So it's much harder for us to organize people, to compel people with stories. On some level, that's healthy, you know, but on the other level, we don't have this sense of collective mission. You know, the kinds of problems we're facing today, whether it's hunger or sustainability or global warming, these are not problems that you can just go, you know, declare a mission to the moon. We're going to stick a flag in the surface of Tranquility Bay and we've won.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't quite work like that. These are kind of steady state, ongoing, chronic issues that don't that aren't represented well in stories with true endings.
Yeah. And yet we still seem to long for it. You find little pockets, and I'm thinking about media now, shows like The Moth, the TED Talks, which are important comedians sometimes who will tell the narrative stories. There are pockets of this, but even public radio is moving in another direction, so you get a whole lot of stories in the course of an hour instead of just delving into something for an hour. Everybody's changing, but we still hold on to the narrative in some ways, and there are still some people who listen to it and who crave it, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, The Moth is interesting as a cultural phenomenon because it's almost story as retro. You know, it's almost like, oh, isn't this cool? People are going to tell stories like they used to. Whereas it, you know, it's a little bit, a bit like, it used to take, you know, Prairie Home Companion for people to actually engage. We had to do it sort of almost cheeky meta, you know, we're doing this ironically. Rather than just, no, it's actually, it feels good. It's actually connecting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, these stories. But yeah, it is. It's interesting that it's not just a story. Like in old radio, it was Gene Shepherd would tell a story over the course of an hour on a radio show. Now it's okay if we get four stories, if it's somehow serialized, if it can be podcast, if it's short enough to be listened to on your train ride to work, on your iPod. It's interesting that we end up with, it's not that these aren't meaningful as they are, but they're kind of very individual. They're very segmented. They're very, it's a very a la carte
yeah.
version of story. Oh, I'm going to go to TED. Look, here's 10,000 talks and I'm going to pick one
right.
and get inspired and then move on with my day.
Yeah.
You know, and it's if there's no real follow through.
Yeah. We have intermittent loss of your voice, so we're going to try and figure that out as we welcome phone calls. Our phone number for you to join this conversation with the author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Douglas Rushkoff is our guest, and I think he's written a book that's very, very important. He's told you some ways that we are very much in the now with all of our digital devices. Do you worry that there is so much, you even get sounds on your computer when you got a story or you got a phone call or and you have to respond to that? Is it keeping us from constructing a meaningful present? Is it also keeping us from understanding where we've been so we can move into a future? Or is it so much putting us in the now that that it's not good for us? In many ways, it's not good for us. What do you think? Here's our phone number. Join the conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Or you can always leave a message for us at the Kathleen Dent Show, the Facebook page. All of this being in the now, all of this digital media comes at a price, he says. The digital world is giving us so much information so fast that we can no longer turn it into knowledge. What do you think? We'd like to hear from you. Let's have a real conversation. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now, is our guest this hour, Douglas Rushkoff. And we would love to hear what you think about this. We're all living in this world. Some of us are much more involved in the world of the present than others, with all kinds of devices and very much engaged in them all day long. Others don't even know how to use some of those devices, so it keeps us from being perhaps too struck by present shock. Our number is 800-486-8655. You have a quote from Aristotle here, Douglas, and I'm wondering if I'm getting it right. Did Aristotle indeed say that when the storytelling in a culture goes bad, the result is decadence? Did he say that?
Yeah, he did. I mean, it wasn't... I don't know if he had exactly the Greek word for decadence is, but that was the gist of what he was arguing. I mean, and decadence, of course, isn't always a terrible thing, but without a story, he thought that there was no sense of connection to cause. You know, everything Aristotle talked about really had to do with that this leads to that, that there's these sense of causes that push us forward. And without an embracing story, then your culture doesn't know where it's going. It can't move towards anything. But I think that's also a characteristic of the kind of time that we had back then. You know, we had really just recently invented print. We only recently had calendars and this notion of a society moving towards anything at all. You know, with the invention of print, we got the messianic urge. We got a sense of progress and laws, and we got history and we got a future. We had goals as a society. So along with that came the kinds of stories, which were very different from Bible stories and stories before that. We got stories now that had these sort of goals and moral endings and senses of recognition. And as a culture, we moved that way. And I feel like that really peaked in the industrial age, when we were using stories as advertising, get people to buy things, keep your eyes on the prize, and have the American dream, you know. And now that we're in a digital age, it becomes much more present-based. We're no longer looking toward the future. We're looking towards, well, what's happening now? That's why I'm calling it present shock instead of future shock. It's much less about what's next than what am I getting out of this?
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls. Amy in Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Just have a comment. When I hear several stories, one right after the other, that are short and trying to get in as many as possible, I come away from that not remembering a thing that I've heard, as opposed to listening to something that's in-depth. And being middle-aged and worried about possible memory loss, I really think this contributes to a sense that I'm losing my mind, I'm losing my short-term memory, but we're just bombarded with so much information in little bits, you can't remember any of it.
I think you're right.
Right. Well, what you exactly. I mean, what we have to remember is that part of the reason these technologies were invented in the first place was to relieve human memory. You know, Vannevar Bush and the very first people who were talking about, you know, computers before we even had computers kept saying that these would be memory machines. We could offload our memory so we could do our active thinking. So the fact that, you know, now that we're using them, we're complaining that we don't have memory anymore. We don't have an internal hard drive in our brain so much. We've offloaded that. You know, it shouldn't surprise us, you know, that that's the case. Young people, you know, it's interesting. Young people are a little bit less concerned about that. And I think partly because they tend to get the gist of things. They tend to make sense of things by connecting lots of little pieces rather than getting one big thing. You know, sense things through connections. That's why their media is so much more about recognizing other pieces of media. You know, The Simpsons or South Park are really shows that satirize other pieces of media. They're not about the story that they're telling in themselves.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing, to be able to sense through connections, is it?
Well, it's not a bad thing. It's just a different thing, right? And if they're not encouraged to make sense in that way, then it becomes kind of a wasteland. Then it becomes a bunch of existential dismay. You know, then it becomes everybody trying to follow the tweets on the Boston shooting or the Boston explosions and nobody making sense of anything.
Right.
So that's why, I mean, what I'm arguing is we have to begin to really teach lateral thinking, to teach pattern recognition, to learn how to make sense in this landscape rather than to abandon sense making altogether.
Mm-hmm. Amy, thanks so much for the call. Anne in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Anne.
You know, I liked Amy's comment,
and yeah.
it makes me kind of leads into what I was thinking, that I can't remember isolated facts. I can't remember columns of numbers, but when they're coherent, when they're related to each other and making a story, then the memory kicks in. And it's like when little kids, you know, they don't always ask what and when, but they ask why and how. And I think that's putting the relationships together is what makes meaning and makes coherence and rememberable things. I go to the Moth radio, not radio show, live show here in Milwaukee once a month. And the stories are reflective. They're looking back and they're relating things to each other and centered around a theme, an announced theme. And it somehow seems like that happens in retrospect. That happens when you look back at things.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can see what your guest just mentioned, the patterns and the repetition. But that's how you get to the how and the why. And that's, and what did he say after the denouement, climax, complications, actions?
The what? Recognition.
Oh, yeah. That's the final.
Hmm. Douglas.
The denouement.
Yeah,
right?
Douglas, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is really what, you know, what I'm trying to do in the book is to give people the tools to make sense of things in this highly presentist reality. That the kinds of tools we use, whether it's stories or histories or cause and effect, which is what the caller's just talking about, when those things aren't as available to us, you know, there are still ways that we can find coherence. You know, and I think that has a lot to do with beginning to recognize the underlying rhythms of what's going on. You know, it's, some of them are very simple. You know, maybe we lived in a world where our work week was organized in a particular way and we knew how it was and we conformed to it. And there was a certain surrender of individuality in conforming to it, but at least we understood this is the beginning, this is the middle, this is the end. Now we don't have that. We could work all the time. We could work at home. We're being tweeted. We all have Blackberries and everything else. So what we need to do is still find a coherent rhythm to that work, right? So one of the things I found out was that human beings live in a lunar cycle, that each week of the lunar cycle is good for a different kind of behavior. So the first week of a new moon, we tend to be very good at adopting new ideas because there's more acetylcholine in our brain. Or the second week, we're good at working hard because there's more serotonin. Or the third week, there's more dopamine, so we're better at partying and socializing. And the fourth week, the last week, we have more norepinephrine, which means we're better at systems thinking and doing sort of structural analysis. So when you know that, you have access to another kind of coherence. It's not the coherence of a story, of an externalized story, the way we've made sense of things, but it's a different sort of sense. And when you find, when you start living according to those social rhythms, you connect to something else. You connect to something very local, very real, just as real, in some ways more real than the story. But if you don't find that, if you really do just cut loose and let yourself float along the whims of the Twitterverse, then you do end up pretty disoriented.
Hmm. What you said is so remarkable. I was thinking about how few of us even look at the moon, much less understand anything what you just said, which is fascinating, about the lunar cycle.
It's funny, you know, and even if we didn't know it, at least our bodies knew it. You know, back when you saw the moon every night. So I'm sure that most even informed Aboriginal people didn't know precisely what each week meant. But their bodies, the reason their bodies manufactured the, you know, neurotransmitters at particular times was because we all had these various cycles, whether it was women's menstruation cycles or the cycles of food or the hunt or socializing. The more we spend our days and nights staring at screens with color temperatures and refresh rates and all sorts of things that seem random but influence us, the less coherent we are, and the more of an untethered experience we have in time.
Mm-hmm. Your book is filled with these sentences that you want to cut them out. You don't want to cut out the book, of course, but you want to write them down and put them on the refrigerator because they're so worth thinking about, and that's why I love it. I don't think we've spent enough time talking about what all this means to us. I love this sentence because it means so much if you think about it. Anything we do now may be preempted by something else. Holy Toledo, do we live our days like that or what?
I think we do. You know, for me, the first time I sensed it, and this was as a young man, was when we got call waiting on the phone.
Oh, I hate call waiting.
And I know. Yeah, yeah. It's the interesting thing about call waiting, even if you choose not to pick up the phone, you're still being presented with a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this false sense of autonomy, right? Oh, well, I get, with call waiting, I get to choose whether I stay talking to my grandma or whether I pick up the new phone call. And if I have caller ID, I can see who the new person is calling before I just maybe make that decision. Well, you have autonomy in terms of you get to make that choice, but you don't have autonomy because you have to make that choice. So no matter what you're doing, you're presented constantly with the alternatives that you could be doing. The phone is vibrating. It's always on. Mm-hmm. And that sense of always onness, of constant availability, is the kind of sensibility that people really, you'd have to work in an emergency room or be an air traffic controller to have lived that kind of experience before.
Yeah. And they all say it's addictive, right?
Well, it is. I mean, what makes something addictive, what leads to an obsessive compulsive relationship to something, is when your brain tries to figure out what's the pattern, what's the underlying pattern. So one-armed bandits, you know, slot machines, they've learned there's computers in those. Those are not mechanical devices anymore. And what they've learned to do is to create these random patterns where every 17, 18, 24 times that you pull the crank, a few quarters spit out. And you keep doing it partly because you get that little reward after all the bad ones. You get that little hint of endorphins and you want more of that. But the reason you really stay with it is because subconsciously you're trying to figure out what's the underlying pattern. When does it decide to give me a little little something. It's the same thing when you're checking your email. There's 20 emails, 30 emails. Then, ooh, there's one little good one. Here's a little money. Here's somebody who I forgot about that wants to say hi. Here's a cute girl that wants to say she likes me. You know, whatever that is, we wait and wait and wait until the little positive one peeks through.
And thanks for your call. Patty in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, I have grown children. I'm 57. My children are all in their 20s. And I find it interesting their relationship to pictures and how they use pictures to tell the stories of their lives. But it's so strange because the pictures are always about, you know, here's what's happening right now. And they don't, a lot of them are via phone, computer, but they don't print them up. They put them on Facebook. And it always bothers me that they're not printing them up. But I'm starting to sort of, to realize, like, okay, maybe I can just enjoy this. This whole picture communication story thing is a thing that can be fun. But the fact that they're not thinking of them, like, I used to think of pictures, like, I'll take this picture so I can look back on it years from now and remember it. But they're just taking it, like, here's what's happening now, and then tomorrow, who cares about that picture? It's just so interesting.
Very. I'm glad you brought up this area.
It is interesting,
yeah.
You know, there's a few ways I've been looking at it. And I mean, one of them, and this is sort of most related to the book, is the notion that pictures exist in the present tense. Sound has to occur in time, right? Without time, you don't hear sound. Sound is the decay of the noise that your mouth has made. A picture is there. It's still. It's in the moment. It can be apprehended without time. You know, it's a blink, it's a pulse. So it ends up being much more the dominant form of communication in a digital age than sound. But it's also less intimate in a way. It's much more like the cover on a book rather than the inside of it, or the appointment in the calendar rather than the appointment itself. And I feel like, especially, you know, you guys know because you're radio people, sound creates a space. Sound has an intimacy that a picture can't. And in some ways, I feel like we're putting up these pictures and sending them to each other, especially you look at the way kids do it, as a way of not connecting. It's a substitute. It's more like a brand, you know, a brand image than it is a genuine connection with another person.
Mm. Yeah, it's one of the wonders of radio. It's a very intimate medium. I hope that what you're saying doesn't portend the demise of this medium because of its intimacy. What do you think?
No, I think it would, if anything, it would portend the renaissance of this medium. You know, because this is where, especially live terrestrial broadcast compared to podcast in some ways, people are aching for things that are live. That's why we see the return to localism, to community-supported agriculture, to the maker movement, to Etsy. People want to reconnect in a real way because the genuine opportunity of digital technology was not to be distracted by Twitter feeds. The opportunity of digital technology, you remember when this stuff first came out, it was we were all going to work at home in our underwear in our own time, on our own schedule. Right? Make stuff for one another and have time. Get time. And instead, when the internet became the dot-com boom, human attention, human time became the new commodity. And so we strap this stuff to ourselves and have it tweet us and ping us all the time and keep us in this state of urgent alertness. And that's not the opportunity of a digital age. That's really just the industrial age being amplified through digital technology. You know, and that's why I'm writing. That's why I wrote this book, to say, no, you know, you don't have to submit to that present shock. You can instead embrace what digital technology truly could offer, which is a release from all of these obsolete notions of time and the entrance to a very real, connected and rhythmic reality that's genuinely social.
Douglas Rushkoff is our guest this hour. His book is fascinating, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. Our phone number for you to be with this conversation. Patty, thanks for your call. Is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. She reminded me, I don't know if this is widespread or not, but if you have children in your house or adolescents or young adults, there's this fad thing that's going on now, too, where I don't even know what they call it. But everybody, you take a picture. So being in the moment, taking the picture now is something that you do a couple times a day, and then all your friends do the same thing. They all see this picture, and then it's gone. I'm not sure why everybody's doing it, but it's really indicative of being in the now, isn't it? Thanks for bringing us into the area of pictures. Well, there's much more to talk about, and we will do so in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. We have, we would like for you to give a neighborly welcome to KP Whaley, who is now on phones. He's been observing Rhonda as she handles many, many tasks at the same time. So he's answering your calls now for this hour of the show. So welcome him. He's moved here from Vermont. So we'll say, hey, welcome to Milwaukee. Welcome to Wisconsin. Before we go back to phone calls, I want to talk about this area because it is a big part of your book. And so help me, Douglas, I just can't understand money very well. It's nothing to be proud of, but I really don't understand it very well. So I know that the whole financial industry has been impacted by this this present shock. And you talk about it in the book, and I have to read it four times before I fully understand it. Everybody else is way ahead of me. But how has this influenced the stock markets and financial transactions and all of that?
Well, there's a lot of book. I mean, most simply, if you think about the stock market, you know, people used to buy a stock as an investment in the future. So you'd buy it, let's say you buy Facebook stock, and then you're hoping that a year or 10 years or 20 years that the stock will be worth a whole lot more. It was sort of you'd buy this thing and hold it, and as the company got bigger, your shares would be worth more. You know, people don't buy stock as an investment in the future anymore. They'll buy Facebook at 10 in the morning, the day that it has its IPO, its initial offering, and then they'll be disappointed when 10 minutes later the stock's not worth more. So they'll quickly sell it.
Oh.
So they're not trying to make money by investing. They're trying to make money on the trade. And now when you find out that you can't really make money on the trade because the stock might not go up fast enough, you buy something called a derivative, which is not that stock now. What you're doing is buying that stock 30 days from now. So the 30 days or 30 months is compressed into that purchase. If that's not enough, you can buy a derivative of a derivative, which is that derivative 30 days or 30 months from now. And the derivatives market got so much bigger than the real stock market that the derivative stock exchange bought the New York Stock Exchange. The New York Stock Exchange just 2 months ago was purchased by its own abstraction, by its own temporal child, if you will. And that's because people are not satisfied buying the real. They need to buy this virtual sort of mashup of an investment.
That's amazing. I mean, that's just amazing, isn't it?
It is odd, and it's partly because the unacknowledged operating system on which we're running our whole economy is time. The central currency that we use was invented at the beginning of the Industrial Age. It was forced upon people. People used to use all sorts of other currencies that were based in grain or labor. There was all these other ways of transacting, and they were much more real time. These were currencies that were really biased towards transaction and what you call the velocity of a currency, to currencies that move around really well. And the problem with them was that the wealthy were getting poor as the middle class transacted and got wealthy. So they invented central currency, which is lent out from a central bank at interest. So what does that mean? It means there's a clock built into money, that money has to grow over time. So it's really good for people who save it, and it's really bad for people who want to try to earn it.
Hmm. Let's go to Sheila in Union Grove. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. When Douglas started with the conversation, I happened to be a nurse. And I thought, oh, well, this is nursing, because nursing is like when you have five patients, it's five potential crises, you know. And so you have to take each bit of information that comes in and weigh it. And you're constantly bombarded with, you know, new information from techs and patients and everything else. And the other thing that is really complicated nursing is that now we use computers. And so you're constantly depending upon the computer to give you information. And if you're on one screen and a doctor calls and you need information from another screen, it's the computer that actually gives the stress, because it's taking literally only seconds. But seconds when you're waiting with a doctor on the line and about a patient that's got, you know, something going on, seconds can seem so long. And so when I was listening to the thing about the people who are buying stock, I thought, wow, to them, those seconds probably seem as heavy as they do to me when I'm talking about a patient and patient's life. But it's also complicated that the way we've gained knowledge from caveman to now, you know, one little thing could, it didn't matter. But now a second really matters in so many ways. And I think it is because of this, you know, how fast information can come to us.
Yeah, and tell me how it used to be before you had all the computers, if you were nursing then, when the doctor called for information.
I can't believe this. I've got a call waiting buzz on my phone.
Oh, no.
That was another thing we talked about.
No.
It's making me crazier. But I'm sorry, Kathleen, could you repeat the question? Because I got...
You're not taking that other call, right, Sheila?
No. Nope.
Okay. Oh, that's amazing. Case in point. Before there were computers, how would you handle the doctor calling for information about a patient? Would you have much less information? So is it a plus that you've got all of that on the computer?
I think that, yes, we couldn't get, we would have paper printouts, which of course are frowned upon now. So if we had labs on the patient, we'd have them all printed out. Now,
I see.
You normally don't write down all your labs. So you might write down the ones that you think are important, but the doctor might think something else is important and want that. So you have to go from whatever screen you're on when the doctor finally calls you back and get to the screen where it's got the patient's information. And sometimes computer systems just take a while to get from one thing to another.
Right.
And so...
Yeah. But,
go ahead, Douglas.
Well, a lot of this has to do with the fact that asking computers and nurses to compensate for the fact that the doctor's not there, that the doctor is being asked to do 100 different things at once, and we're trying to pay less for healthcare than we would otherwise. You know, when the doctor had the time to be in that space with you, there wasn't this sense of rush and distraction, you know, with him out in Chicago and you in Milwaukee and the patient on another floor and everybody trying to arrange everything virtually. So as I see it, this is a misuse of technology, that we're using it as a compensation for the fact that we don't have time to be present anymore with one another.
Thank you, Sheila, very much for calling in. I hope you totally ignored that other call, because if it's important, they'll call back, right? Thanks for the call. Jim in Newport Township, Illinois. Hi, Jim.
Yes, thank you for two excellent subjects this morning. Two comments I wanted to make is, I think, turning the subject back to the news media, it is the person that does not have an appreciation of history, which is probably about 90% of everyone, that is most subject to this concept. The only thing that matters is what's being presented to me at the moment from the media. And the other point I wanted to make, maybe I'll just leave my comment.
But I think you were going to say something which is an important point, that of the news media getting things wrong. Were you going to say that?
Well, the other point I was going to try and make is that the first report is most likely to be the least accurate, because for one thing, many of the facts that are later to come out are missing.
Right. Right, that's true. Douglas.
Yeah, one of the worst features of present shock is that we tend to value recency over relevancy. Mm. And you see this trend throughout Twitter, even in the Google searches that you get, as if what was said most recently about something matters more than what we know to be the most relevant, the most true thing about something.
Very interesting.
And that's a dangerous bias for a society to move into.
Yeah. The other thing that's really dangerous here, and tell me what we do about this, considering we're not going to get rid of all these devices, that's what happened. If we live in the present, we're not really thinking about future anymore, so that you write about without long-term goals, because we're not doing that, people lose the ability to respond to anything but terror. We talked about this a little bit earlier. But when you're trying to solve huge problems like global warming, like all kinds of other issues, how are we going to be able to do that living in the now?
Well, we have to live in the real.
Oops. Are you there, Douglas? Our fancy technology kind of fell apart here. I'm sorry. Well, we'll get an answer to that because, you know, we're living in the now, so there are other ways to get hold of them. Are you there now?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So
I'm
here. You know where you
were.
You know where you were.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in my conversation with myself here. That's funny. No, the opportunity, though, is to reconnect with the now that you're in, your actual local now. So even if we lose a sense of what's our future and destiny as a nation, on the other hand, if we begin to use that as an excuse to say, well, where do I live right now? Where do I source my food right now? What sort of energy consumption am I using right now? That can actually start making, it can start addressing real problems. So we're no longer using less energy or making less pollution because we're envisioning 200 years what's going to happen and arguing whether it's true or not what's going to happen in 200 years, but rather doing it because it feels awful to be making this smoke, because I can see right now what mining this stuff is going to do to my community. I can, you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
more a matter of readjusting to your current real-time experience of what you're doing rather than arguing about an abstracted future.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim, so much for your call. Carolyn Oak Creek, hi.
Hi. Yes, I found myself bombarded with the now. So last year I conducted an experiment. Got rid of my TV, no Facebook, no Twitter, no
Ooh.
Cell phone. I'm much happier.
Ooh.
I stay informed through the radio, internet, at my leisure, and email, nothing else. I'm just as well informed of the news, and I am less stressed and more happy.
Huh. Well, that's quite remarkable
yeah.
to live in. You're living in a different world, Carol.
I know I am.
Yes.
I'm reminded of that from my nieces and nephews.
I would imagine.
But it's working for me, and I still don't have the TV, but breaking news, I can check it out on the internet, read it more in depth, and, you know,
right.
not be so bombarded with stuff.
Do you suggest we all do that, at least for a short period of time, Douglas?
I would just try it. You know,
yeah, you
for a couple weeks.
All right,
least.
Carol, I think it's a good idea. Should we, Douglas?
I think everybody should make conscious choices about what technologies they bring into their lives.
Mm.
It's not a matter of being anti-technology, but being willing to choose none of the above. Right? I got rid of Facebook because I decided I just didn't want to deal with a world where people from second grade that I've spent 30, 40 years getting away from can suddenly show up into my present, and where marketing from my future that I don't even know about has been, sorted and created through big data engines that know more about what I might buy in the future than I do. So that was my choice. I think as long as no one feels compelled that they have to use one of these things when they don't want to, then we can use them authoritatively and by genuine choice, rather than out of some sense of obligation to keep up.
Mm. I guess, Carol, that's what vacations are for, too. I make sure that we don't have any of those while we're on vacation. And it's good. You look at the moon. You look at the stars. Well, Douglas, thank you. Your book is just such an important contribution to now and to the future, I think. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Douglas Rushkoff, his book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. He is a media theorist. He's written a number of books, and he is a commentator on CNN, contributor to The Guardian, Discover, NPR. He has made documentaries that have been highly acclaimed, The Merchants of Cool, The Persuaders, and Digital Nation, and he advocates for digital literacy and teaches at NYU and also the New School. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to our new producer, just arrived this week from Vermont, KP Whaley, who did some on-air production for this hour. So those were good hours, huh? Thank you. Until tomorrow.